Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. In this digital age, technology continues to be a disruptor that has been at the center of much of the social, political, and economic progress that we have witnessed in the last decade. And technology has been responsible for connecting the world into what has been called a global village. Take an example of Facebook with its over a billion users. People from the remotest areas around the world have been able to connect and access the same kind of information as those in more developed countries. But with that said, many scholars are beginning to question if the advancement in technology that we see has actually led to a leveling in the playing field. And today's guest, Ramesh Srinivasan, says that while we think of such social media platforms as Facebook and Twitter, which has been growing at an unprecedented rate in Africa, Facebook, Google, to mention just a few, Ramesh, who will be joining us today to talk about his new book, Who's Global Village, says that even though these platforms are as open and accessible to all, we have to recognize them as purely commercial entities that were developed primarily by and for the Western world. Ramesh says that when you look at how these new platforms or technologies as a whole shape our world, they often reinforce the inequalities of globalization that we've come to see. This because essentially the people who are involved in creating these technologies have a Western understanding of the world, and that they would not necessarily reflect the perspectives of those at the bottom of the digital divide. And so in his new book that we'll be discussing in depth later on in the show, he asks us to reimagine what the internet, the mobile phone, or these social media platforms may look like when they are considered from the perspective of the diverse communities that consume it.
Amate Vincent in Arua, Uganda. Yeah, I use Facebook. I've been using Facebook for the past 3 years like that. So I've realized that it's really a good platform for we as the youths, because it makes us to know more about what is happening in the world, also here in Uganda at large.
My name is Achom Diana, and I'm an advocate. I work with the Uganda Human Rights Commission. There is lack of African content in the Facebook arena, let me say that. But all I could say is maybe these Africans, us who use the Facebook, should be the ones to infiltrate it with African content. Because most of the things we listen to are from outside. Most of the things that we get from Facebook are from Western people. Because it's them that take the initiative to do more of the research and to. Because we know a lot of Western culture because of Facebook. They do a lot of their things that they put on Facebook, a lot of it. Then us, we copy them.
Facebook should be more of African content, because the culture of African tradition is somehow missing a lot. Something must be done to improve the content so that Africans look to see that it's a way of connecting them.
I'm called Donald Jaloka and live in northern Uganda.
We would have liked to have the African culture, you know, incorporated on Facebook, so that our future generation will also access it. Because now that we are going to a world, to a global world which is full of science and the technology, so the Facebook should incorporate African culture, so that our new generation can come and search about how our past generation lived.
Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. This is Jackson Vunganyi. And on this show today, we are asking whether these new digital technologies are actually bridging the gap or creating a greater divide in the world around us. And on the show today is Ramesh Srinivasan. Ramesh's new book, Who's Global Village, asks a very pertinent question of who are we shaping with the digital technology revolution today? Ramesh says that we need to start to visualize a world where technologies serve diverse communities rather than the Western consumer. Ramesh, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Tell us about your book, this new book that you just released.
Yeah. So the book actually comes out of my own path. I'm trained as an engineer. Mm. And I was really interested in, as the internet was expanding, right, over the last 15 to 20 years, all over the world, I was interested in what it would mean, because it's made such a huge effect and impact on this country and on the developing world as well. So basically, the book traces my travels to different parts of the world, from India. There are some stories from Africa in there. There's stuff from the Arab Spring. There's a lot of discussions of indigenous communities. And these are all people who are increasingly connected, not only to the internet, but to mobile telephones.
So your book is a product of all these years of traveling to these different communities.
It's full of stories.
How long have you been working on it?
I mean, the book I was writing for, basically I wrote the book between 2012 and 2015. Mm. And then it took about 2 years because of the publishing process with my press.
What inspired you? Why did you start the process of writing this book?
I felt like there's a really powerful message that has to be said, that isn't said really enough, which is that as we think about the internet and new technology, we can't forget culture. We can't forget people. Mm. We can't replace what is actually human and social and cultural by simply thinking about technology. I mean, remember, all these technologies, whether they're old or new, including African technologies,
are designed for people.
And by people.
By people.
Right.
So then that brings us to the question is, who is designing these technologies and what kind of values do they bring to this process?
Yeah, so basically I actually wrote a piece for Quartz, the website, the Atlantic's website, about an example about how this biases of Silicon Valley and specifically engineers within Silicon Valley are actually reinforced in terms of systems that we treat as if they're neutral. Mm. So I mean like Google search results, or when you log on to Facebook and you see in your...
Wait, these are not neutral?
They're not neutral because they reinforce the biases put into them by their engineers. So I want to give you an example from Africa. Mm. I was invited to visit the country of Cameroon, as you know, in West Africa. And I was really excited to go there. The first thing I did was I searched on Google for Cameroon. I knew a little bit about Cameroon. But I said, if I search on Google already knows probably that I'm planning on going to Cameroon. Maybe it knows that I care about international and global voices.
Because Google has a way of tracking you.
Absolutely.
It tracks all of us.
So much data is gathered about us, even when we're not logged in.
Right.
And I searched for Cameroon.
That's scary.
And the top web pages I found were not actually websites from Cameroon.
So you were in Cameroon when you searched about Cameroon?
No, I was in the United States planning my trip.
Okay. And so you wanted to learn something about Cameroon, so you Googled it, but the search results did not reflect the information that you were looking for.
Exactly. And what was that? So the information I was looking for was actually the experience of being in Cameroon, or like what it's like to be in Cameroon, or what Cameroonian people are doing or saying, or what their lives are like.
So the search results did not reflect that.
It was like the CIA World Factbook.
Does that mean that information doesn't exist on the internet, or that Google did not give you that information when you asked for it?
That information does exist, but Cameroon is a much smaller country than the, you know, kind of Western world, if you will, or America. Mm. And there are many more people who create web pages in this part of the world than in Cameroon. So Google is actually filtering what I see and what I accept as the truth about Cameroon, essentially, because 99% of people basically don't really go to page 2, 95 right. approximately.
They don't go further than the second page. And usually that's where you find that information.
That's right. And we see 50 to 60% of people only looking at the top 3 results on page 1.
And so these results are actually decided by people, by engineers who are designing these sites and deciding which content you see.
Indirectly. It's through the algorithms.
That was my next question. Sure. We usually hear this big word, algorithm. For the less tech-savvy people like ourselves, explain to us why we should be interested in algorithm.
Right. So as more and more data are available, especially online, the question of why you see what you see, that's an algorithmic choice. So what an algorithm is basically a mathematical way to query, to ask a question to a body of data, so it selects certain forms of data. So like an algorithm is basically a repetitive technical way of taking the signal from the noise, right? Mm-hmm. So an algorithm doesn't necessarily mean something that's mysterious or, you know, in fact, the word even has a relationship to Persian mathematics from hundreds of years ago. So it's not a Western thing. Mm-hmm. It's basically the technical aspect that determines why you see what you see and how you sort through information. And now we're in this moment of what we call big data, which basically means there's more and more data available than ever before. Everything we do, there's some digital signal of, we have data about. So you can actually analyze that data algorithmically and make choices based on what you're going to see and what you're not going
to
see.
And so these choices, and we'll get to big data later on, but these choices are not made by, say, a computer somewhere. It's actually made by an engineer, a person, by a human being.
Yeah, so engineers design algorithms, which then implement those sorts of choices into your search results or your query results.
And in the process of designing these, they bring within themselves their biases, their values,
potentially
their understanding of the world.
Because, and that's not even like them trying to do wrong
nefarious.
To the world. No, it's certainly not. It's just that we always create things based on how we see the world, right?
Absolutely.
Like, you know, if I tell a story, it's based on how I see the world. If I design something, it's based on how I see the world.
Right.
And it just so happens that Silicon Valley engineers tend to be, generally speaking, white males. And there's, of course, a lot of people like me, like Indians, that work there.
Right.
But the cultures of Silicon Valley are based on certain types of values and ideas, right? So basically, it's the idea. There's certain, like, philosophies, right? So, like, there have been some research that's shown that, for example, what we call artificial intelligence, which is basically choices that are built into algorithms that operate almost automatically, they actually reinforce particular ideas of, like, what white male people actually choose in the world, right?
So, so there are these bubbles, obviously, that inform us on a daily basis. So what you're trying to say is that the Google engineer in Silicon Valley, their worldview is different from the person consuming this information somewhere in Cameroon.
Because the internet has become so global in its scope, right? So now, as the internet becomes an increasingly global infrastructure or experience for people, the question is whether the diversity of its users are going to be reflected in the platforms that dominate the internet. Remember, almost 2 billion people are both Google and Facebook users, right? These two platforms are the most powerful platforms in our world. Maybe you could even say the most powerful companies in our world.
Absolutely. In the history of the world.
Possibly.
How important is Facebook in terms of how we consume information? I mean, I think Facebook has over 1 billion users right now.
1.8
billion users.
By far the biggest
website.
That's
a lot of power as a company to have.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. And a lot of social responsibility, which they, of course, claim to have, but I don't think they do enough, actually.
And you're saying that they should have more people who reflect the diversity of the world
Precisely.
That we live in and the consumers.
And they need to tell us as users why we see what we see,
right.
What alternative ways we might see information. They might need to let us know how we can see information outside of our own bubbles, right? And the reason why Facebook is so important, let's think about it in this country, in the United States, is that Facebook is the major platform where Americans get their news, right? So, and something that you would never know, because at least I'll say for myself, I never would have known, is the most powerful politically circulated news source during the time of our election last year was Breitbart News.
Breitbart News.
Which is a small website that started kind of on the fringe and became the most powerful, more powerful than CNN, Huffington Post, Al Jazeera, you know.
They're getting more traffic than all these major media organizations.
On Facebook.
How were they able to do that?
That's a great question. So that's partly because they were understanding, or the people involved in the political campaign of the president were understanding how to basically gather data on American voters and to influence voters with various sorts of political news sources, right? So it's not really like an advertisement, like buy these shoes. It's more like, hey, here's a news story you might like, and you can click like the page if you want. We all see these. These are basically like political advertisements that don't really look like advertisements because it's news stories, right? And so that's part of it. And then part of it is also that, like, it tends to always be the case with, like, people all over the world, I believe, that when you see something that's more sensational, like the fake news stuff, which is not the same as Breitbart, but it's a fake news thing. Breitbart's more
you
like...
You click on it.
You click on it. It's because it makes you... It stops you from your kind of normal attention span. At Facebook, they've done some studies I've read about where all they need is 3 seconds or less. I mean, a little bit around 3 seconds, let's say, 2 to 3 seconds, where you actually look at some video or some news story or some news source, and that's all you need to actually influence your sentiment or your political opinion. And so some of those sentiments might be about people changing what candidate they support or their opinion on a news story. But actually, some of them are just about, hey, I don't want to vote anymore. I don't want to get out and vote. And I'm not saying that they were trying to get people to not vote.
Right.
But some forms of political advertising, news sources can actually have that influence.
And they help to compound some of the biases.
Precisely.
How do they know who to target?
Oh, it's incredible how much data is being collected about us as Americans. And it's very different than the European Union. And in Africa, I'm very interested to know what the situation is. But they claim to have 5,000 data points about 220 million Americans.
Wow.
That's their claim. And so let me explain how they gather that data. So anything we do these days, Jackson, we actually are leaving some sort of digital trace, right?
Like some footprint.
Footprint.
Right.
Yeah, data trails, right? So if I buy something with my credit card, that's data. If I use my phone for something, that's data potentially. If I install any software, like tracking software, which is basically done whenever I have Facebook and Google, like cookies and so on my computer, that's data. So you can buy all this data because in America, we don't have very strong data privacy laws. The internet service providers can sell your data. So now all this data is available about you as an individual from very distinct potential sources, right? Like I never thought that like what shoes I bought would be connected to what news website I liked on Facebook.
But they can make the connection.
Aggregation, right? Bringing them together. And so when that data is all brought together, you can actually develop what they call psychometric profiles, right? Like I'm neurotic, you're open.
That sounds scary.
And then and you already have the demographic data, which was being used by President Obama in 2008 election, by Howard Dean before in 2004 primary against John Kerry.
Howard Dean was very effective in
it
that.
Was the beginning.
Those are the early days of... Yeah.
And Obama's teams was masterful on what we call micro-targeting. But psychometric micro-targeting, rather than demographic micro-targeting, is a sort of different situation here.
It's a whole different ballgame.
So you can actually understand what types of news and information sources might influence one's psychological state. Imagine if you have almost the exact same story, but you do four different versions of that story based on not who the person is simply demographically, like you're a Rwandan, I'm an Indian, but actually I'm an Indian that's neurotic, or you're a Rwandan that's like anxious about this but open about this.
Right.
So you can have far more textured, personalized, targeted media. And that's because Facebook has opened itself up to that. And it's also been, you know, very much exploited for the fake news issue. And they're trying to do something about it. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg is apparently going to do an interview with NPR soon. That's what I just heard.
He had the paper, just wrote a paper about it.
Yeah, the manifesto.
Sort of research.
And he acknowledged these problems, but he also said, we will develop better technical solutions. This is not a technical solution. It's not simply that. It's about a conversation with people, being more transparent, being more conversational.
Right.
Because they are a public media network, even though they're a private held
exactly.
company. They're both.
It is quite scary. I remember in the early days of Google doing this when we started getting our Gmail accounts in our Gmail inboxes, informational emails about products that we might be interested in. Usually it's because we had just made a purchase of something. And we used to ask ourselves, how do they know that I saw this? And those were the early days. But these are 15-year-old companies with so much power in this lifespan that have been present, 1.8 billion people using Facebook. How will they look 50 years from now? What kind of power do you envision them having in 50 years from now?
Well, I mean, if it follows anything like this trend, they're going to be as powerful as any nation state, if not more powerful. I mean, it was interesting that story when the prime minister of India, Prime Minister Modi, came to the United States. He had a meeting with Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook before he met President Obama, right? So it's like that's happening. Another thing that's happening is these companies are not simply we always think like Google's just search. It's not just search. It's a company that acquires so many other companies that are both software and hardware platforms. I mean, Google's investing heavily in hardware internet infrastructure, right? They're trying to connect places in the world, for example, in Central Africa, through their networks, right? So like they're gonna provide you, they're like your internet service provider. They're gonna provide you with drone internet, or in this case, they call balloon internet, high power balloon.
And actually India saying no to that.
In India kicked Facebook out.
Right.
Because Facebook was saying that you can use our internet in these parts of India that don't have coverage for free, but it's actually Facebook's version of the internet. Uh-huh. So it's going to be not net neutrality. It's going to be the opposite, where you can only see
what Facebook
things.
Decides for precisely, you, precisely. Which pretty much kind of happens right now. I guess this is the million-dollar question then.
Yeah.
How do we become better media or information consumers in this landscape?
Yeah.
So that is saturated.
We need to understand there's a bunch of things we do. I actually think it's time for like a bill of rights around data. And like, you know, like we have a bill of rights in our constitution. We also need a bill of rights around data because data is so powerful. Data is like the oil of the new economy.
Of the digital economy.
Absolutely. It shapes politics. It shapes economics. I mean, this is the reason why a company like Instagram was sold to Facebook with like 10 to 20 employees for over $1 billion,
right?
This is a new power in this space. So here's some things we need. I think, first of all, we need to, in certain cases, think about legal possibilities around privacy.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and people need to think about what's appropriate. I think second is Americans and people all over the world need to develop what we call digital literacy, which is like understanding what is and is not being collected about you and what you're okay with and what you're not okay with. And so we have to act accordingly. And part of that is actually us thinking about what we feel okay with publicly sharing and what we don't feel okay with publicly sharing. And one thing to think about is, as we think about diversity of all the different cultures that are now part of the internet,
mm-hmm.
not all of them have the same philosophy
absolutely.
As the West about right. free information.
Right. Hold still, Ramesh. We'll be right back. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. We are talking to Ramesh Srinivasan, author of the new book, Whose Global Village? Rethinking of How Technology Shapes Our World. In the book, Ramesh argues us to kind of rethink about the internet, the mobile phones, and all these different social media platforms would look if they were considered from the point of view of the diverse cultures around the world.
To connect with people, family and friends, especially those that I haven't seen in a very long while, or they live very far, so we don't have a chance maybe to visit each other and things like that. So it's so much easier to connect and talk through Facebook. Yes, I'm on Facebook because I love chatting with people across the country, not only in Malawi, because I have a lot of friends who are abroad, so I think it's the easiest way for me to communicate with such friends.
It's a social platform where we meet and chat with friends. We get updated with so many issues.
I would prefer international because there's a lot that is happening out there, but we don't cover it on our local media, you know. So I would prefer international just to get more.
I do read news on Facebook just once in a while. It's not necessarily that something that I do often. But if I come across news, I do read it. Mostly I come across international news. But if they could also up their game when it comes to local news, I think it would be nice. It's very rare moments you come across local content on Facebook. Normally it's to do with football.
Welcome back. And guess you're just joining us. This is Upfront on Voice of America. We are talking to Ramesh Srinivasan, author of Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. Now, Ramesh, I wanted to ask, you know, how does then Google or Facebook, all these other companies, how do they reflect their diversity in the information that we consume? Does it mean that they hire engineers from India or from Africa?
Right. I don't think there's enough being done. Now, Google definitely has, and Facebook, I think, growing. They have offices and subsidiaries in other parts of the world. Of course, in West Africa, there's a lot of tech boom in Nigeria and Ghana and so on. But I don't necessarily think that those forms of engineering and those forms of design actually are reflective of like an African knowledge system or an Indian knowledge system. If anything, it speaks to sort of how globalization functions, where like you might be, in Bangalore you call a local number, you're talking to someone in Bangalore on the call center, but that person is supposed to behave for an American consumer. They're not supposed to behave like someone from that part of India.
That's
right?
Why you call Bangalore and somebody called John.
My name's Bill.
Bill picks up the phone.
Not Ramesh.
And you can tell he's a Ramesh, but he's Bill.
Yeah, and they do things like accent training. And the other thing that I think is a problem is a lot of these guys, because of the time difference, it's the middle of the night for them. So there's even some research studying their brain waves, their fMRI. These are like forms of what happens with globalization. So my main point is that as these technology platforms and even companies globalize, the voices that inform their products and their protocols may not be globalized.
And so how do they make them globalized? How do we bridge that divide?
Yeah. So this is what I was arguing in the Quartz piece. Mm. And I was arguing this in context of Facebook and news and political news in America in a piece I published with CNN a few weeks ago. Mm. And basically what I'm saying is they need to think about some, you know, it's a platform, but the platform doesn't have to be centralized algorithmically, right? Like it can actually layer itself to show different kinds of different options, different modes of designing and organizing information and give users the possibility of choosing between these, right? So like, for example, if I'm looking for something on Google about the news in relation to Syria, like Google should give me the opportunity to see both conservative and progressive, left-wing, if you will,
right,
news sources in conversation with each other. Or maybe I can do that on Facebook, because again, part of the problem with Facebook is my friend network mostly shapes what I see.
Right.
And my friends, it's hard. They're not really that politically different than me. We tend to be more, you know, from the liberal perspective.
But what would be the interest of these companies, of say for Facebook?
Yeah.
They're already making money from this targeted advertisement, from targeted organizations or political parties,
yeah,
or political entities, yeah, who are targeting you.
Yeah.
With this information that, yeah, speaks to either their base or to their, you know, whatever political platform they have,
yeah,
what would be their interest to kind of like, yeah, reshape that?
Yeah. I mean, I think most of the money they make is definitely from, you know, commercial and economic advertisers. And for whatever reason, Americans and maybe people around the world kind of said, okay, I'm okay with giving up my data, so, you know, targeted shoes and this and that could be sold to me. But it's different when it starts to go into this political space.
Yeah.
So they are making a lot of money. They're incredibly powerful and wealthy on a revenue level. But they also are realizing that there's an issue here, partly because people like myself are speaking up about it. And I don't think the public is too happy about how their platform essentially was really successful in spreading fake news,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Also, Twitter did. And so, like, I think that they can actually, it could be a win-win here. It could actually support the bottom line of Facebook to be a little bit more socially and globally communicative.
Mm.
And they can actually build the trust of us even more so. And all that what suits their interests is us simply being on the platform, right? Because simply being online is all they need, because they're gathering so much data about you. Even if you're not doing much on Facebook, they're gathering data. Data can be gathered in lots of ways, like how long are you looking at this? How long are you looking at that, right? So if they are to kind of say, hey, we're creating all these opportunities for you based on who you are, not in a black box way, but in a little more transparent way to enjoy our platform in these adaptive, local, community, cultural-based ways, I think it's a win-win for them. And I don't think it's actually technically that difficult to pull off.
It would be easier to actually do it, yeah, and they would still be able to make money.
Yeah. You just got to work with social scientists. Like, people like me do this kind of work. I'm not sure I really want to do that with them, but I think it's important to think about that.
Let's talk about your trips. You've made various trips to the continent. What was your experience in terms of how people use the internet, consume information?
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, there's such differences, right? I mean, you see it in Africa. In Africa, it's fascinating. It's such a mobile phone oriented culture, right? First of all.
Mm.
And second of all, there's so much what we call street up innovation, right? And you see that also in like places like India as well. And also in some places in China, where you'll just go like on a street corner, say you're in, you know, Kigali, or I was in Bamako, and you're at some street corner and like there's just people like soldering the iPhone. yeah, like they know how to crack and open up things. And even though that's seen as some sort of like illicit or like illegal thing to do, I actually think this is what innovation is. I think people have to develop livelihoods and businesses, and there's such an intelligence where they don't say, oh, this iPhone it's going to have a life cycle and then I'm going to throw it away and right. I'm going to buy another. That's not what happens in parts of the world where there's less, there's this myth of infinite resources in the United States. But to be completely honest, we just export our resource problems to other parts of the world. Exactly.
Thank you to Ramesh Srinivasan, and thank you to all our listeners around the world who tuned in on the show today. So if you have any comments or questions, I want to connect with us. My Twitter handle is at Upfront Africa. Check us out on Facebook, keywords Upfront Africa Show. Hit the like button and share with your friends, and we'll catch you next time. Goodbye.